This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa, and thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyus Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In terms of the potential to go to school, access to education, disruption of health services, of course, which has been critical during the last year of the response to COVID-19. And of course, the access to water and sanitation, which are generally desperately affected by climate shocks across Africa.
That is Dr. Samuel Godfrey, UNICEF's Water Sanitation Hygiene Chief in Eastern and Southern Africa, on how children have and could be affected by climate change. Details coming up. Also, Uganda has received COVID-19 vaccines from the United States as part of President Joe Biden's commitment to donate 500 million doses to 100 countries over the next 2 years. These stories and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Ethiopia has urged patriots to join the National Army and allied regional militias to battle the Tigray People's Liberation Front and its new ally, the Oromo Liberation Army, signaling potential expansion of the conflict countrywide. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has recently described the TPLF as a weed that must be uprooted, while his officials have lampooned the hypocrisy of foreign powers for not reprimanding the TPLF. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi what is needed for a political solution in Ethiopia and the impact of the conflict on neighboring countries.
The escalation of the conflict beyond Tigray into the Amhara region, Afar, and now the Oromo regions does very much threaten the viability of a unified Ethiopian state. And I think that is exactly what the Tigrayans have in mind at this point as a means of creating a zone of autonomy for themselves. That said, this conflict is very much a political conflict. It has been from the very beginning, and thus there are political solutions if the respective sides would choose that path. Now, this would require compromise on all sides, something that we haven't seen a great openness to. It would require the Tigrayans to retreat to defensive positions within Tigray, protecting their populations. At the same time, it would require the federal government to open up humanitarian assistance and trade links to Tigray. It would require the government to recognize that Tigray needs access, you know, to roads and the movement of goods if Tigray is going to survive as a region within broader Ethiopia. And so, you know, this would require the government and Abiy to tamp down this caustic rhetoric against the TPLF and to recognize that the TPLF has a valid political role to play in part of a national dialogue that really now needs to look at what does a unified Ethiopia look like with a strongly independent Tigray that would function and work under some sort of democratic constitutional order. I think these are the questions that would need to be sorted out on a political level if we're going to find a political solution to this conflict.
So how could this conflict impact Ethiopia's neighboring countries?
Well, all along, this conflict has very significant regional implications. You know, we've seen the spillover of refugees from the beginning, but, you know, there are all sorts of regional interests to try to gain influence and seek greater leverage in the Greater Horn of Africa. And so clearly, you know, the TPLF has been seeking more support from Sudan and Egypt on its support of its cause. We know Eritrea has been involved on behalf of the Ethiopian government. There are Gulf actors who are applying for influence on both sides. And so absolutely, the longer this goes, the more it can metastasize and create more instability in the broader region. Unfortunately, the situation seems to be going in the wrong direction from where we were even a couple months ago. Both sides still seem bent on finding a military solution to this. And, you know, it's very hard within that culture to compromise. And this is part of, you know, the whole mentality that needs to be created if you're going to realize some sort of power sharing arrangement. And unfortunately, the history in Ethiopia is always you've had a unitary dominant leader, and that seems to be the model that so many of the actors are trying to pursue. Now, it's interesting because Abiy was breaking that mold and was trying to create a more encompassing, inclusive political arrangement, and there was more freedoms. And that's the real tragedy of this, that the Tigrayans were, you know, just not willing to go along with it. And so they took their stand, and then it ended up escalating, I think, in ways that neither side really anticipated. And now they're all reacting to that.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The head of the U.S. government's humanitarian agency, USAID, says food for millions of hungry people in Ethiopia's Tigray region is running out. Samantha Power says her organization and other humanitarian groups have depleted their food stocks warehoused in Tigray. According to Powers, people are starving, with 5 million in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. On the other hand, Belen Siyum, the spokesperson for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government, says more than 10 international aid groups and UN agencies are active in humanitarian efforts in Tigray, and that the federal government is also providing support. Ethiopia's federal government troops and forces from the Tigray People Liberation Front, TPLF, have been fighting since November in a conflict that has killed and displaced thousands. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres pushed yesterday for an immediate ceasefire and unrestricted aid access in Tigray. Guterres told the reporters in New York that it is time for all parties to recognize there is no military solution, and that it is vital to preserve the unity and stability of Ethiopia, which is critical to the region and beyond. Rwanda has received COVID-19 vaccines from the United States as part of President Joe Biden's commitment to donate 500 million doses to 100 countries over 2 years. As Eugene Wimana reports from Kigali, Rwanda's government says with the support of partners like the U.S., it will hit its target of vaccinating 30% of the population by the end of this year.
The U.S. government delivered 188,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccines to Kigali over the past week, quickly followed by more than 300,000 doses. In an exclusive interview with VOA, the U.S. ambassador to Rwanda, Peter Vrooman, said the delivery of the vaccines promised by President Joe Biden goes through partners who decide how to allocate them.
And so the allocations are made in consultation with the Africa Union and COVAX. So they know best which countries have which cold chains and which needs at what time.
COVAX is the worldwide initiative to get vaccines to low-income nations. Its backers include the World Health Organization and Gavi, the Global Vaccine Alliance. President Biden's commitment to share vaccines comes after several human rights groups said rich and powerful countries are hoarding vaccines, while vulnerable people in poor nations are dying for lack of shots. Ambassador Peter Vrooman says that given that the lives of unvaccinated people are at stake, vaccines should be provided.
Tonight there'll be 300,000 doses, and that I'm sure will go quickly into the arms of Rwandan citizens who are waiting at and eager to receive the vaccine, especially at this time of the Delta variant. So wherever you are in the world, we have to do our best to be mindful of how viruses spread, what we can do to stop it, and vaccination is a key way to do so.
Rwanda is currently battling the COVID-19 variant Delta. Daniel Ngamije, Rwandan Minister of Health, told the Rwanda Broadcasting Agency the government is grateful for help.
We commend partnership between our government with the U.S. government, but also with other partners who are part of COVAX, like UNICEF, WHO, and other partners, because this mechanism works, and this will allow us to vaccinate and increase the coverage of people who should be vaccinated with different vaccines that are now available.
The Rwanda Biomedical Center reported that on Thursday there were 496 new cases and 16 deaths, bringing the total number of deaths to 996. The World Health Organization reports Rwanda has had more than 81,000 cases since the pandemic began 18 months ago. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Residents of northeast Nigeria's Borno State have mixed feelings about repentant fighters from Boko Haram and Islamic State of West Africa who have been surrendering to the military with their families. Borno Governor Dr. Babagana Zulum says the people must decide whether to forgive and reintegrate them or allow the fighters to go back to the bush. Dr. Abubakar Sani, a Maiduguri-based public affairs analyst, spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye about the situation and urged caution.
What we know is this, that members of Jama'atul Ahl al-Sunan al-Da'wati wal-Jihad, JAS, who were formerly under the leadership of Sheikho, are the ones surrendering. And it is because the new leaders, you know, in town, the Qureshi and his people, are trying to punish some of the Sheikho members, especially because when Sheikho was alive, they killed so many Muslims. And those killings were unwarranted, were uncalled for. And as far as, you know, the interpretations, the Islamic interpretations of the Iswa factions, you know, is concerned, those killings, you know, deserve to be punished for.
What has changed to make some want to leave the militant forces?
Some of the members of JAS now being asked to observe fasting as a way of penitence, and some of them have been detained and so on and so forth. So for that, they are surrendering. There is so much uncertainty that they now think they better surrender to the government of Nigeria than to stay with the new leaders of the insurgency. Let me just say this. If you take notice of those who are surrendering, many of them are not coming with any weapon. There's not any weapon in their hand. Just women and children and the elderly and so on and so forth. So it's not something to rejoice about. Understand, rather, I think we should be very cautious because it might be a change of tactics and strategy. Because even those ones that have surrendered, how are we sure that they are not coming into the society to act as spies, to monitor what is happening so that they can, you know, organize a takeover from within? The DSS and most especially the people, you know, community locals should watch them very well and see that, you know, this thing does not degenerate into something, you know, that will be very catastrophic. That's just my opinion.
How successful has the Nigerian government been in trying to reintegrate former militants?
The Nigerian government, I don't think, has succeeded much in reintegrating those terrorists, those repentant insurgents, and what have you, back into the society. Not because the government is not serious, but because people hardly accept them. I know of a situation whereby a lady who was rescued or who surrendered was brought back to the society, and her father rejected her because she came with a baby, and the baby is the son of one Amir who was killed. So the issue is not even about the government. People, I don't think there is any sensible person that would agree to coexist, to stay in a community together with someone who is a member of Boko Haram, because people believe generally that those people cannot change.
Opinions are divided on whether the repentant fighters should be forgiven or prosecuted for their crimes. What's your take on this?
Opinions are divided, it's true, whether these people should be forgiven or prosecuted. I'm of the opinion that many people feel that these people should be prosecuted. And even if the government will say they have forgiven them, the people in the community, in the state, have they forgiven them? No. So maybe they should come up with a plan, like maybe to say they will pay dia, you know, to the families of the bereaved. Dia for each life lost or something, to assuage the feelings of families of those who have been bereaved. Because you can't just tell me you killed my mother, you killed my father, my brother, friends, and now you say you've repented and government is giving you a VIP treatment and I should keep quiet. No. So this thing needs to be looked at critically. The Office of the National Security Advisor, Borno State Government, Ulamas, you know, MOD, maybe Red Cross and so on and so forth, should come up with a holistic plan to see how this thing could be properly managed.
That was Dr. Abubakar Sani, a public affairs analyst, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye by telephone. Authorities in Uganda have suspended 54 aid groups, accusing them of failing to comply with regulations. Heads of the accused groups say they are being harassed for political purposes. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Addressing journalists in Kampala Friday, Stephen Okello, the executive director for the National Bureau of Non-Government Organizations, said the 54 NGOs were not complying with the country's NGO law. He said some organizations are operating with expired permits, some have failed to file annual tax returns, and others are operating without registering. He said all must halt their operations with immediate effect. Okello, speaking at Uganda's media center, cited examples.
The first one is Chapter 4 Uganda that has not filed returns from 2016 to 2020. The second is Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, commonly known as SEDU. Now, SEDU does not only have issues to do with the filing of returns. They have issues like they proceeded to observe elections without having accreditation from the Electoral Commission.
In December 2020, the executive director of Human Rights Group Chapter 4, Nicholas Opio, was arrested on allegations of money laundering. At the time, the organization was reportedly collecting evidence surrounding the killings and arrests that occurred during 2 days of protests in Uganda that began on November 18th. A top official of the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, Miriam Atembe, says they have only failed to file tax returns for 1 year because of COVID-19.
And we went into lockdown, and the challenges have been quite a lot. And if within that year you are a bit late in submitting return, I do not think that that should earn us a suspension. So, me, I'm thinking maybe, I don't know whether there could be another reason behind, as you may imagine.
Godbert Mshabe heads a research group, the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies, which the NGO Bureau said is operating without registration. Godbert says a suspension letter received Friday morning accused the NGO of not disclosing its activities. He argues that by law, his organization is only required to register and comply with requirements under the Companies Act and not the NGO Bureau. He says the NGO Bureau was instituted by the government to harass organizations.
The NGO Bureau has been consistently used as a tool to politically and administratively harass Ugandan NGOs and Ugandan NGO leaders, and actually even for democracy activists.
Okello says all district NGO monitoring committees have been put on alert to ensure all the NGOs named do not operate. This is not the first time the government has targeted NGOs. In February, several NGOs were forced to either close or scale down activities after the government ordered the suspension of the international NGO Democratic Governance Facility. Eight development partners formed the DGF in 2011 to provide well-coordinated support to state and non-state entities in order to strengthen pro-democracy campaigns and protect human rights. In suspending the DGF, President Yoweri Museveni said that the fund was exclusively foreign-managed and that its activities were calculated to subvert the government. Halima Othmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
UNICEF has released its first ever child-focused climate risk index. It lists young people in the Central African Republic, Chad, Nigeria, Guinea and Guinea-Bissau as most at risk from climate change. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to UNICEF's Dr. Samuel Godfrey.
Godfrey is the water, sanitation and hygiene chief in Eastern and Southern Africa. He says this UNICEF index comes shortly after the release of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's sixth report, which shows urgent action is needed. He says the report predicts an alarming increase in temperature of 1.5 to 2 degrees centigrade by 2030, about 15 years before the previous predicted analysis. Godfrey says UNICEF felt it was important to indicate how this change will affect the rights of children across the world. He says the UNICEF index indicates that approximately 1 billion children, nearly half the world's 2.2 billion children, live in one of the 33 countries that are classified as extremely high risk.
Of those 33 countries, there are countries within East and Southern Africa which are in the top 10. Angola, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Madagascar, Somalia, and South Sudan are extremely affected by climate shocks. We've seen an increased number of droughts, cyclones, and floods within those countries.
Godfrey explains how children have and could be affected by climate change.
In terms of their potential to go to school, access to education, disruption of health services, of course, which has been critical during the last year of the response to COVID-19. And, of course, the access to water and sanitation, which are generally desperately affected by climate shocks across Africa.
He's outlined what UNICEF is urging governments and businesses to do.
The CCRI report is really calling on governments and the private sector and partners to do three things. The first is really to honour and codify the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is recognised within the Paris Agreement on Climate Change. This report analyses that most governments that have established national determined contributions, in fact 60% of them, do not contain any reference to children or youth at all. And so we're really calling on governments to put children at the centre of all of their climate adaptation and climate mitigation efforts. The second thing that the report really calls on is really a mobilisation of effective finance, climate finance for climate adaptation. At the moment, about $574 billion is available for climate finance, and only $35 billion of that goes to climate adaptation activities, and very little of that is within Africa. So mobilising the finance, the climate finance towards Africa is the second. And the third is really placing the rights of children and youth at the heart of all climate action, whether that's in terms of legal frameworks or the ways we adapt our curriculum within education.
UNICEF says the launch of the Children's Climate Risk Index coincides with the third anniversary of the youth-led global climate strike movement, Future Fridays, started by 15-year-old Greta Thunberg. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhivi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international.